My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
Her small body is in my hands. I'm running to the hospital. Electricity is off, and the inner hallways have turned into hospital cots. The girl is dead. I know that. The pressure of the explosion has cut off her thin veins. I know she is dead, but everyone who sees me runs after me. Me and you. You are alive for a moment when living people run after you.
That was the Palestinian poet and teacher, Mus'ab Abu Toha, reading his poem For a Moment, inspired by an image he saw from Gaza of a man running through a hospital carrying a dead girl's body. Mus'ab is today's honored guest on Kalam, and we'll be getting back to him in just a moment. But first, we'd like to remind you that if you like the show, please subscribe to it and rate it in whatever podcast application you're using right now. It helps others find us. Please also tell your friends and family about the podcast. And if you want to support us, you can by joining our Patreon community. For just $3 a month, you'll gain access to full-length interviews and great bonus content. Now, on to the show.
أعيدك في الفروض والاستخارة وأرقي كل مأذنة وحارة من الصاروخ لحظة كان أمرا من الجنرال حتى صار غارة أعيدك والصغار قبيلا يهوى تغير بابتسامته مسارة.
I grant you refuge in invocation and prayer. I bless the neighborhood and the minaret to guard them from the rocket. From the moment it is a general's command until it becomes a raid. I grant you and the little ones refuge, the little ones who change the rocket's course before it lands with their smiles. That was an excerpt from the Gazan Hiba Abu Nada's poem I Grant You Refuge. Hiba Abu Nada was a poet, novelist, and nutritionist. Her novel, Oxygen Is Not for the Dead, won the Sharjah Award for Arab Creativity in 2017. Hiba Abu Nada was killed by an Israeli airstrike while in her home in Khan Yunis on the 20th of October, 2023. She was 32 years old. We'd like to dedicate this episode of Kalam to her and all of Gaza's murdered poets. If you're listening to this episode, you've undoubtedly been following the events in Gaza since October 7th, just over 6 months ago. I say events, but really what I'm talking about is a cataclysmic disaster that could set off a regional, if not a world, war, and what many legal experts are calling a genocide. Of course, none of this really started on October 7th. This entire podcast is meant to show that. But the events that were set in motion after the brutal attack by Hamas that claimed over 1,000 Israeli lives will reverberate through history for generations to come. The highest number of Israeli casualties since the 1948 war. The indiscriminate murder of civilians perpetrated by Hamas and others constitute war crimes. I believe it is more consequential than the 9/11 attacks and the wave of destruction that followed. Since then, Gaza has been turned into an apocalyptic graveyard. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel's bombing campaign, including nearly 14,000 children and 8,000 women. Over 70,000 Gazans are injured and over 8,000 are missing. 1.7 million people have been displaced, and we have all witnessed the intentional destruction of most of Gaza's infrastructure, which has led to starvation and disease. Under the guise of defeating Hamas, an ideological movement that I personally do not believe can be defeated by force, Israel bombed and in many cases obliterated hospitals, water purification and sewage plants, electric, telephone and internet systems, schools, universities, libraries, mosques and churches. If you've listened to the previous episodes of this podcast, you may have been surprised and at times shocked at the levels of tragedy and loss. But the death and destruction we've witnessed since October 7 far surpasses anything we've seen since 1948. Since October 7, 2023, I have personally been in a state of shock and angst, anger and depression. I'm sure many of you can relate. A cherished family friend that I never had the chance to meet because of the blockade on Gaza died as a result of Israel's bombardment and siege. I choked on my own tears when I heard the terrified fear in my dear friend Sammy's voice, a journalist in Gaza who's done invaluable reporting for Swedish radio. I've heard children tell stories of finding the severed limbs of their relatives among the rubble. I've witnessed the killing of at least 103 journalists. I have seen hospitals raided and bombed, in one instance killing hundreds of people. I have seen fathers kissing their dead infant daughters. I have seen a surgeon perform an amputation of his own niece's leg without anesthesia. I have seen mothers weeping in a way I have never before experienced. I have seen the blatant violation of international humanitarian law. I have seen war crimes. What I haven't seen, however, is the kind of outrage one would expect from so-called Western democracies. On the contrary, I've seen complicity. I've seen my own government smugly tell hundreds of its own citizens stuck in Gaza trying to escape Israeli bombs, "Well, you should have thought twice about traveling to Gaza. After all, we advised against it." The same government expressing deep sympathy for Israeli casualties and losses. I've seen Western pundits try to relativize the destruction of hospitals and schools. I've seen Western politicians claim that all of this is justified. The killing of nearly 14,000 children is justified. When I think of the people of Gaza, I think of the song Unadikum by the Lebanese singer Ahmed Qaabour, based on the poem by the Palestinian leftist politician Tawfiq Ziad. In it, he sings, "I call out to you and press my hand into yours. I kiss the soil under the soles of your feet and I say I will die for you." Solidarity from Stockholm to Cairo to Gaza and beyond.
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم.
Today we're going to hear from a born and raised Gazan, Musab Abu Toha. Musab is around my age, and we actually grew up just a two-hour drive from each other. The distance between Gaza and Amman, Jordan, is about 150 kilometers. But because Musab happened to be born in Gaza, he was never able to visit Jordan or even the West Bank. I've been to more parts of Palestine than he has because of the Israeli occupation and the 17-year blockade of Gaza. Musab Abu Toha worked as an English teacher in an UNRWA school before the war and writes poetry in English and Arabic. His 2022 book of poetry, entitled Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, won both the Palestinian Book Award and the American Book Award. In 2017, he founded the Edward Said Library, an English language public library in Beit Lahia in Gaza. There is currently no information on whether or not that library is still standing. Due to his literary success, he managed, through painstaking effort, to travel to the U.S., where his youngest son was born, giving him the U.S. passport. Because of this, Musab and his family were able to escape the inferno that is Gaza, and they are all now residing in Cairo, Egypt. That is where I spoke to him, from the garden of the building he's living in the Cairo suburb of Ma'adi. The sound quality is not the best, but I hope the quite pleasant sound of birds chirping in the background will make up for it. Anyway, without further ado, here's Musab Abu Toha. Musab Abu Toha, thank you so much for your vivid poetry and storytelling, and welcome to the Kalam podcast.
Thank you, Edgar, for having me.
So you're in Cairo right now after having managed to escape Gaza with your wife and three children. So, first of all, how are you coping in Cairo and how's your family in Gaza?
Well, this is not my first time being away from Gaza. Maybe this is the third time I'm outside of Gaza. But this time is very different from the previous ones because we are outside of Gaza, not because we are maybe studying or because we decided to live, you know, abroad, but because we had to leave Gaza after a lot of dangerous situations. We had to evacuate. And especially we had the chance of leaving Gaza because our youngest child is an American citizen. We are staying here and we don't know for how long. This is the one thing that we are not sure about. As for my family in Gaza, I mean, most of my family members are in North Gaza, which is facing a starvation caused by Israel and the worldwide siege over Gaza. I mean, I have two siblings living in South Gaza. So, I mean, people in the South are struggling differently from the people in the North. But thankfully, all my family members are not hurt. But my wife lost an uncle of hers last December. He was shot at the entrance of the school where he was returning after he was kidnapped. I mean, in general, my family is doing well.
We recorded this interview about a month ago. Since then, tragically, Musab's grandfather died in Gaza. This was Musab's last living grandparent. Okay, I'm very sorry to hear about your wife's brother, but I'm glad that most of your family are alive and doing relatively well under the circumstances. I won't ask you to recount the details of your horrifying experience when you were traveling from northern Gaza to southern Gaza with your family. It's well documented in your really brilliant letter from Gaza, published in The New Yorker in December of 2023. In short, you were kidnapped and tortured by Israeli soldiers for 3 days before you were released following international pressure. And you said that that was the first time in your life you ever saw an Israeli soldier, despite being born and raised in a Gaza that's under Israeli siege and occupation. What's the significance of this, of you not having seen an Israeli soldier in your entire life?
Well, I mean, it's been a very strange experience because we have been killed by Israel. Our houses have been destroyed by Israel without us seeing these people who are killing us and who are taking everything that we love from us. I'm not sure how the Israelis have been seeing us from the sky or from the tank or from the warship. But at least when I was, you know, next to them, I mean, I thought of them as humans, but I'm not sure how they saw me as a person. I thought that maybe for many of them, I think it was the first time for them to encounter Gaza. So that was a different experience from when I was taken by the soldiers, when I was handcuffed and blindfolded, and I was beaten, I was treated as an animal. You know, I was accused of atrocities that I've never committed in my whole life. But on the other hand, these Israeli soldiers have committed massacres against my people, against the children and women of Gaza. And it was not only about soldiers, but it also was about the tanks and the jeeps, the military jeeps. I've never seen them with my own eyes. But for me, when I evacuated North Gaza, heading towards South Gaza, there was only about maybe 10 meters between me and the tank, you know, the huge tank where the Israeli soldiers were hiding. But we as civilians didn't have any place to hide behind. We were just hiding behind the wall.
Yeah.
And under the ceiling that were crushed over our bodies. You know, I witnessed a lot of massacres, one of which was about just 70 meters away from where I was staying with my wife and children and my parents and my siblings and their children. So, you know, I mean, soldiers hiding behind, you know, steel, and we in Gaza, most of us are not soldiers, are not fighters. We're just hiding in our rooms and in the inner hallways of the houses.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly that's not how someone considering you as a human would treat you if they saw you as a human being, the way that you were treated and the way that countless other Palestinians have been treated by Israeli soldiers. How did that dehumanizing experience affect you?
Well, I mean, the thing is that it was not only me who was treated inhumanly. There were many hundreds of other people next to me. I was not kept alone. When I was taken from the queue of people crossing from north to south Gaza. I was not the only one who was picked. I was not the only one who was forced to be naked in front of the police soldiers. I was not the only one who was blindfolded and handcuffed.
While traveling to southern Gaza via the so-called safe passage, Musab and his family encountered an Israeli checkpoint. There, a soldier called out his full name, Musab Mustafa Hassan Abu Toha, before he showed them any ID. He is then abducted, along with 200 other men, and forced to strip naked. He's blindfolded, and his hands are tied behind his back. For 3 days, he disappears, kidnapped by Israeli forces and taken to a military base in the desert in southern Israel. There, he is severely beaten, accused of having ties to Hamas. During his time at the base, he could hear artillery shells being fired into Gaza. He remembers wishing his heart would stop as a result of his suffering and fear.
But for me, I mean, I wished that a heart attack would end my life when I was taken away from Gaza, when I heard the motors of the tanks, and when I also heard the artillery firing their shells into Gaza. So this experience of hearing this sound when the artilleries are just a few meters maybe next to me when I was kidnapped. And then when I compare it with the sound of the shells when they fall in Gaza while I was still there, I mean, this was horrifying. I knew that these shells were fired from a place very near to me, and they are falling maybe on my parents or my students, yeah, who were sheltering at schools. I think it's part of the war for the Israelis, you know, to treat us as animals, as non-human, because this would be the only reason for them to, parenthetically, to protect themselves. I mean, in order for them to protect themselves, it means that they should kill us. And in order for them to kill us, they need to imagine us as non-humans.
Yeah.
So that's how I understand it. So I think the big challenge for the Israelis and for any other person, it could be someone from Palestine, you know, for them to see the other as a human being, to try to understand why they are acting like this, you know. So I understand that these people are killing us and they have no emotions when they press the button of the bomb. They don't see us as humans, but this is their fault. You need, the first step for you to be human is to see others as a human.
Yeah.
And this is something that the Israelis have failed to do, and their government is helping them see us as non-human because they don't show on their TVs, you know, whatever the Israeli airstrikes are doing to Palestinians, especially children. I mean, there are now, as we are talking right now, more than 31,000 people were killed, more than half of whom were children. And the fact that most of Gaza's population are children is absent from the discourse. This is one thing. The other thing is that I read many times on social media, people commenting, Zionists, commenting on my posts. And I read these comments. They say everyone in Gaza deserves what is happening to them because they chose Hamas. I mean, come on. Now I'm 31 years old. When the latest elections took place, it was in 2006. I was 14 years old. I didn't vote for Hamas. I didn't vote for Fatah. I didn't vote for anyone. And now I'm 31 years old and I have children. And I also have my wife with me. We didn't vote for anyone. And by the way, I mean, you don't tell us who to vote for because this is democracy. We vote for whomever we want. The same way that we don't ask you to not vote for Netanyahu or for Lieberman. I mean, it's your country. You vote for anyone. But this doesn't mean that I approve of anything that my government does. You know, this is something that they don't understand and they don't want to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly, it's, I mean, this kind of hypocrisy when Western, in quotation marks, democracies talk about democracy, it seems like it's only for them. It's very selective. Certainly, it's not for Palestinians.
Yeah. Also, the fact that they are asking us to eradicate Hamas. I mean, these people who are Hamas are part of the Palestinian community. I mean, regardless of how you see them, but they are part of us. You do want to start us fighting each other? What about the occupation? Why is there anything that is called Hamas in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, Hamas was founded in 1987. I mean, but what about my grandfather who was expelled from his house in Yafa in 1948? Would he think of, I mean, he's dead. Well, he died in 1984. I mean, if you tell him, oh, Hassan, you should kill Hamas people. I mean, this is not his concern. He wants to return to his home in Yafa. He's dead now. But I have the right, and my parents have the right to ask for that. They don't ask for the eradication of Hamas. They ask for the end of the occupation and for the freedom of everyone, regardless they are Jewish, they are Christian, they are Muslims, anywhere. I mean, freedom doesn't have to do with who you are.
Yeah. So you mentioned your age. You were born in 1992. And I mean, you and I are roughly the same age. I was born in 1993. And I spent many years of my teenage years just 4 hours car drive from you in Amman in Jordan. And because you just happened to be born in Gaza, it's been impossible for you to make that journey to Amman by car. Even just the sort of 1 hour or even below 1 hour journey to Jerusalem. And you've described in previous interviews how even copies of your book have traveled more in the West Bank and in Jordan and in the neighboring countries more than you've done. So what does this experience of being sort of locked into Gaza, what does it do to the people of Gaza and especially the young people of Gaza?
I mean, for your information, I have friends who are now maybe 35 or 40 years old, who have never left Gaza before. They don't know what the outside world looks like. And not because they don't have the money or they don't like to leave Gaza, but because this is the situation. People in Gaza do not control their border crossings. I mean, if you want to leave Gaza, you need to sometimes pay money. Sometimes you have to be approved to leave. So just imagine, not only do you need a permit to enter, let's say, a country, but even to leave this country, you need a permit, you know, because we don't have anything that allows us to control when and how we can leave our, you know, country. I mean, Gaza is part of our country. And it's ridiculous when sometimes I get some phone calls. I mean, I've never been to the West Bank. I've never been to 1948 cities like Yafa, Haifa, Akka. I've never been able to go to Jerusalem multiple times because the Israelis denied my permit requests many times, even to attend a visa interview at the American embassy.
Yeah.
So it's been ridiculous when I got some phone calls from FedEx, from USPS agents in the West Bank, asking me if I could come to the West Bank and collect my books. Because they do not deliver to Gaza. So they are asking me to go to, let's say, to Ramallah or to Jericho in order to pick my books. Well, if I could do that, I mean, I would, you know, go back and forth multiple times. It couldn't only be a journey dedicated to collecting my books.
Here, Musab is talking about receiving physical copies of his 2022 poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, from his American publisher. The postal service delivering the books called him up and said they unfortunately do not deliver to Gaza and wondered if maybe he could come to the West Bank to pick them up. Obviously, totally impossible for any Gazan to do.
But I myself haven't been able to leave Gaza except when I was 27 years old, and it was to attend my visa interview in Jordan, in Amman, where you were born. And I couldn't go to Jordan directly. I had to go to Cairo, and from Cairo, I took the plane to Jordan.
Yeah.
So, I mean, life in Gaza is unimaginable. People think that Gaza is just, you know, Gazans are just a group of people who just want, some trouble. They enjoy being in trouble. No, people in Gaza have been deprived of many things, including an airport, a seaport, freedom of movement. We don't control the border crossing. I mean, Gaza, when we say Gaza is under siege, it has two dimensions. People can't leave Gaza when they want. And they even cannot return when they want. For example, in 2021, I was in the United States in February, and we decided to go back to Gaza to visit our family after spending a year and a half in the States. And we, because it was COVID, we couldn't know whether we are allowed to land in Egypt because the border crossing could be closed and we wouldn't be able to cross the same day. So we were not sure if we had any permit from the Egyptian authorities to land in Egypt because they could send us back to America. And even to enter Gaza, you need to have this Palestinian ID card, you know, because if you are from the West Bank, you can't enter Gaza. So Gaza is a prison because you can't leave it just like any normal prison. And this is an additional feature. You can't enter Gaza except if you have the permit to enter this prison. So even if you want to enter this prison, you need to have a special document, which is the Palestinian ID card.
Yeah.
And that proves that you are a resident of Gaza.
Yeah. The way you talk about Gaza is interesting, because on the one hand, just like you did now, you in your writing, you're very clear and straightforward about the oppression and the hardship that the people of Gaza face. But on the other hand, you also write about Gaza with warmth and love and really sort of sensitive affection. How do the bombs and the massacres and the siege and the political chaos live side by side with the quite beautiful way you describe your friends and your families and even like the vegetables in your parents' garden? How does this coexist in your mind?
Well, I mean, they coexist because they exist in real life together. For example, I could be drinking from my teacup, and at the same time, I would see and watch an airstrike happening maybe a few hundred meters away from me. I could be picking some strawberries from Beit Lahia, where I grew up during the past 20 years, and I would see an Israeli soldier opening fire at people, at the young people sitting, you know, just watching what used to be Palestine, you know. I could be sitting on the balcony with my children, when one of my children confuses the clouds for bomb smoke. That happened one time when my son Yazan, he was 5 years old. He said, Daddy, there is a bomb there. And I looked up and it was the cloud. He thought that the cloud was bomb smoke, you know. So they coexist because we have been living with it for a long, long time. I mean, Gaza is not under war, I mean, for the past 2 or 3 or 4 years. I mean, I was born in a refugee camp, and the first time I saw an Israeli airstrike was when I was 8 years old. That was during the first few days of the second intifada, the second uprising. And I mean, for me, I see myself as a still a child, because children don't usually ask who is doing this to us, you know, or why. But the most important thing, that it is happening. I mean, they see a bomb, you know, killing people. They see the lights of the bombs, the explosions, but they don't usually ask about the details. Why is this happening? When it's going to? They don't ask anything, but they live the moment. And for me, I live the moment when nature and violence coexist.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of talk in the West in the past few years has centered around mental health and trauma. How do you relate to that term? Do you consider yourself traumatized by growing up in Gaza?
Well, I think I mean I could be traumatized, of course, because I was kidnapped and I wished to die by heart attack when I was taken, and I didn't know at the moment where they were taking me. I thought they were going to execute me somewhere, you know, in the desert. Yeah. You know, that happened. I heard that the Israeli tanks and the artillery shells fired into Gaza from a place very close to me. So, of course, I'm traumatized, but I think this trauma is subdued because I see other people's suffering and their wounds and their fear, and I see my trauma as a little one compared to theirs. So I don't think of my trauma as a real trauma. You know, when I see videos and photos of children and their parents and some corpses still under the rubble, and people who have been taken by the Israelis for at least 3 months, and no one knows anything about them. And then I look at my trauma and I think, I'm lucky, I don't have to complain. But I think this trauma, I don't live this trauma until I'm writing about it. I mean, when you talk to me, you don't feel like I'm traumatized, but when it comes to writing poetry about these things, I can see a lot of the trauma on the page.
Yeah. How is it? Are you still inspired to write poetry despite this? What's happening in Gaza right now? It must be one of the most difficult periods in your life. Do you still write right now?
I get inspired sometimes by some stories that I hear, some videos that I see and that I don't understand. I mean, and one time I saw someone, a young man running, carrying the body of a dead girl, running in the hospital. And I didn't understand why is this happening? I mean, if someone is killed, I mean, why would you run with his or her body? So I tried to understand this in a poem. I wrote a poem for that, imagining that this young man is running while carrying your body, and other living people are running after you. So you are alive as long as these people are running after you. So you are alive for a moment. So that's the title of the poem, For a Moment. So you are alive for a moment. So I try to understand this by trying to bringing this girl to life, because these living people, including the person who is carrying the body of this dead girl, because this living person is running, so he's giving life to this girl, even though she is dead. So I'm trying to understand these things through poetry sometimes.
Yeah. Would you consider reading this poem for us?
So the poem is titled For a Moment. Her small body is in my hands. I'm running to the hospital. Electricity is off and the inner hallways have turned into hospital cots. The girl is dead. I know that. The pressure of the explosion has cut off her thin veins. I know she is dead. But everyone who sees me runs after me. Me and you. You are alive for a moment when living people run after you.
Thank you very much for reciting that. Your poetry is certainly very strong and direct. And I listened to the conversation that you had with Naomi Shihab Nye, which was a great conversation, I think, that gave me some really good insights into the way that you write. And if we stick a little bit to your poetry, you write in both Arabic and English, and you've previously said that mm-hmm. your English poetry began when you were updating the world on social media about the attack on Gaza in 2014, and that people around the world on social media noticed that you had a poetic style when you were describing the realities in Gaza at the time. So your poetry, at least in English, is born out of a kind of activism or even like a journalist reporting style. Is this how you view it?
I think that the stories that I'm trying to tell are not journalistic stories. They could, I mean, journalism is about what's happening, you know, in people's real life. And for me, poetry has this element, but at the same time, it has the emotional, you know, the emotional side. So poetry for me is about people's real life. I mean, especially that we are living in Gaza, that I'm Palestinian. My poetry would be about the people around me, my life, because my life at least is representative of many other people's lives. I mean, being born in a refugee camp, not leaving Gaza for decades, not having, you know, the freedom of movement, etc. So it's about my life as part of this community. But at the same time, it's not about the story itself, but it's about also the emotions and feelings that come with hearing or telling the story of me and other people. So a poem could be a retelling of a story, but a retelling with the emotions and the real feeling that come with the experience that I'm sharing with the whole world.
Yeah. You've also compared the mass displacement of the people of Gaza that is happening right now with the 1948 Nakba. And in the first two episodes of the Kalam podcast in this series, I spoke to the Palestinian author and architect Suad Al-Amri, who her parents also fled from Jaffa or were displaced from Jaffa, just like your grandparents. And she's written an entire novel about the Nakba. And she said that what's happening in Gaza today is even worse than the Nakba. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's worse than the 1948 Nakba, because what is happening right now is is live streamed all over the world. The whole world has taken part in this Nakba. It's not only about Britain or the Zionist movement, but everyone is involved, including the Arab countries. I mean, of course, they are dropping and sharing, you know, and the dropping of the food from the sky. But this is not saving people's lives. And for the U.S. to be sending a few boxes of food and dropping it from the sky to Gaza, but at the same time shipping, you know, mass destructive weapons to Israel, this is, you know, this is very hypocrite. This is ridiculous in many ways.
Yeah.
It's like giving someone some band-aids and at the same time giving the other person who is wounding them more knives.
Yeah.
So the whole world is watching this and they are unable to stop it, even though they can stop it by stopping to ship weapons to Israel, by stop providing it with fuel for its tanks and its warplanes, and also by imposing a ceasefire. Yeah. I mean, America has been an obstacle in the face of the imposing of a ceasefire from the start of the war, you know, and they are pretending to be caring about the hostages' lives while Israel is killing these hostages by randomly and by generally bombing neighborhoods, not targeting a house or two, but I mean blowing up and bombing whole neighborhoods, you know. So if they cared about hostages' lives and the world, I mean everyone in the world has a mind to use, you know. But I mean, this is not a concern for Israel to save their hostages. Their concern is just to kill as many Gazans as possible. And this does not have to do with Hamas. This is very clear. I mean, if you look at the numbers of the people, if you look at the video, I mean, if they don't believe the Ministry of Health in Gaza, you just look at the photos. I mean, there are many international journalists and human rights activists who came to Gaza. Very few of them. But they came to and they saw the situation. They saw the hospitals, how people are just lying on the floor of the hospital getting treatments, and some people who had their limbs amputated without anesthesia. This is very inhuman, and the whole world is unable to put a stop for that. So the whole world is responsible for this current Nakba of 2023.
Yeah, it's certainly, I'm sure, will be remembered as a historic shame and failure for that world leaders in 2023 and 2024 were complicit in this mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza. But at the same time, we have a lot of young people, mainly in the West, who are protesting and who are leading big sort of mass movements in support of Gaza. Quite inspiring coalitions in the U.S. of Arabs and Jews and people of color and every kind of background you can imagine coming together to try to force the U.S. to change its policies. Do you think this has an effect, and how do you feel when you see this kind of thing?
Well, I think the change on the world's viewing of what is happening in Gaza, what is happening in Palestine in general, is a very positive change, and that's been, you know, received with some hope from us in Gaza and Palestine. I think we are not going to see this change in real life these days or these months, but at least in the coming years, when the Palestinians have no government support them, but at least we have the people of the world on our side.
Yeah.
And I said it in one of my posts that we don't have an army in Palestine, but we have the whole world, the free people of the world, standing on our side. So let these people be our army.
Yeah.
And there is one thing that I would like to highlight here, which is that no matter what Hamas did, whatever they did it as a movement, a military movement, but whatever is Israel doing, it is doing it as a country, as a state, as an army, you know. And everyone in Israel is taking part in that because everyone was enlisted in the army, whether early October 7th or later. But for us in Gaza, most people are civilians. Most of the people who were killed are children who had no part to do with this. So whatever Hamas did, they did it as a movement, regardless of how they perceive, of how the other people perceive what they did. But they did it as a group, as a movement. But whatever Israel is doing, you know, the mass killing of Palestinians, they are doing it as a state. So this, there is a big difference between what Hamas did and what Israel has been doing to us, not after October 7th, but since its occupation of Palestine. And I think the whole world is seeing this, especially the young generation, whose minds are not, you know, contaminated with Zionist propaganda.
Yeah. So your 2022 collection of poems, your book, is entitled Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. So, Musab, what are some of the things that are hidden in your ear?
Well, there are the, you know, the voices of my family in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. There are the voices of my students when they raise their hands to answer a question that I ask in my classes. There are the voices of the, you know, vegetable and fruit sellers in the street who go out in the morning and return in the very late evening selling their apples and their mangoes, etc. There are the voices of the birds. Maybe you can hear some birds behind me, but yeah. Also there are lots of birds in where I used to live in Beit Lahia. There is also the voice of the Holy Quran on the radio or the news broadcast. There are also the voices of the children playing, crying or screaming or laughing or shouting at each other. But at the same time, there is the sound of an F-16, the sound of the drone, the sound of bullets, the sound of explosions. And now I've added new sounds, the sound of the Israeli tank just a few meters away from me, the sound of the artillery firing its shells onto my family and neighbors in Gaza. There's also the new voice of the Israeli soldier talking to me and asking me to get naked and also to lower my head. Even though I was blindfolded, they kept hitting me on the head, asking me to lower my head, even though I couldn't see anything. So this is a new voice in my ear. And also there is the sound of my heart wishing to stop, because I was very scared when I was taken away from my family without knowing what the Israelis were going to do to me and others with me.
Yeah. I'm so grateful that you took the time to speak with me. Musab, I don't want to take so much more of your time. I know that you have a lot going on. Ubardu Ramadan. Is there anything that you feel like you want to add to this conversation, or something that I didn't ask you about that you feel is important that you want to say?
I'm working these days on my second poetry collection, and that I hope it will be coming out early next year, which is a very speedy process in terms of publishing. So, my current poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, is being translated into French, and it will come out in August or early December, September. So I'm very happy about how the world is taking my work. I mean, whether publishing poetry or publishing essays. So this gives me some hope, and also, you know, getting some interviews on TV and also on podcasts like this is also something that brings hope to the Palestinian issue.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I really look forward to reading your new collection when it comes. Musab Abu Toha, thank you so much for being a guest today on the Kalam podcast. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Edgar, and all the best with the Kalam. And I look forward to listening to the forthcoming new podcast.
Thank you. I'll habaat lak link.
Inshallah, كتير كتير. شكرا كتير يا Edgar.
أنا تشرفت.
وإن شاء الله نشوف بعض وجه لوجه.
إن شاء الله. أنا أول ما أجي مصر أنا. That was the award-winning Gazan poet Musab Abu Toha, and the sixth episode of the Kalam podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. With this episode, the chronological series on Palestinian history comes to an end, but the series on Palestine will continue. From now on, we're going to do interviews with writers, activists, artists, and musicians. Next week, we're going to hear from the Palestinian author Ibtisam Azem, her 2014 Book of Disappearances is a fascinating and chilling surrealist novel which imagines a world in which all of a sudden, all Palestinians disappear. That's next week on the Kalam podcast. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.